Call the meeting to order. Representative Haas, I'm sure you've read the minutes. And
I have.
Move them for us. Minutes of the February 7th meeting.
So moved.
Has anyone got any additions or corrections? Representative Atkins? Not all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed? Motion prevailed. Chancellor, welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we're just delighted to have this opportunity to be with you again, and we understand that we'll have a, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we understand that we'll have just a relatively brief opportunity to finish the presentation, and we know that many of you have some questions and discussions, so we hope we have, Mr. Chairman, if it's agreeable with you, at least an hour for the discussions. I need to make some introductions. Yesterday at the meeting, maybe I should say that when I first was asked to serve this organization, one of the things that I heard is that we needed to be building the alignment and the working together with the presidents, the office of the chancellor, and the governing board. And one of the ways that we integrated into our operation was the creation of a leadership council. And the leadership council is made up of the 32 presidents and the senior officers of the office of the chancellor. And we then have broken that group down further so that there's a president co-chair. In other words, Laura King would have a president with her as a co-chair of the finance committee, and the same for the other board committees, academic affairs, and so on. And each year, the 32 presidents elect one of their colleagues to be the co-chair of the leadership council with me. And the current chair is President Frank of Inver Hills Community College, and the past chair is Dr. Barden from MSU Moorhead. So these two leadership individuals are part of this. And almost everything we do in terms of taking things to the board and so on, we try to work together so that we have the benefit of the thinking of the presidents as we develop the agendas and the policies and so on. And I think it's worked well. So our two colleagues are here. And what I'd like to do then is to continue the discussion yesterday by asking the two remaining vice chancellors to have a presentation here on these major line items, and then we'll want to respond to questions. And I will be here at any point so that if a vice chancellor turns to me, if you do, so that I can do my best to answer your questions. But I do want to just start where we did yesterday when Laura King was telling you about the inflation request for $57 million. And I just wanted to begin that is so critical. We've estimated that on the 3.25%, we need about $130 million. And part of the board's budget request had the tuition number at $73 million and the inflation number at $57 million, and the intent was that would be the inflation amount. So that 57 that we talked about yesterday is so critical, and it did not appear in the governor's budget. And I just wanted to say a word about that, and then maybe questions will come up. And now I want to roll to Ken Neamey, who will be talking about the enterprise technology line item, Mr. Chair, if that's agreeable. Okay?
That's fine. Ken? Tervetuloa, Herra Niemi.
Kiitos. Hyvää iltapäivää, puheenjohtaja Rukodina ja hallitusjäsenmäärä. Minun maini on Ken Niemi.
Good so far. I mean,
I understand. Yeah, that's all the further I'm going to go into,
okay.
Because you can talk circles around me, as I found out the other day. So I don't want to look like a bad thing, but I didn't quite learn the language as well as you did. So I gave it a shot. How's that?
Well, I'm actually half Italian and half Croatian, but I'm the world's first born again Finn. So.
Okay. Well,
I spoke in tongues when I met my neighbor who had a sawmill. So.
I had a good hot sauna last night, as I talked about a lot of uses of it, so I've been beating myself. I don't think you need to do that for me today. I've done enough on my own.
We won't.
By the way, we'd also like Melissa Fining, who is our assistant in this area. She's not an assistant. She runs the show for us, frankly, on all of this stuff. And we're glad that she's here to help us go through these presentations as well. So we want to recognize her at the table, too. Mr. Chair, we're starting on slide 19 for the members that may be there in the handouts. You know, I know you've heard from some of our students about the negative effects of an inadequate technology infrastructure for the online services provided by the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, including student registration and, in particular, online learning. The experiences the students talked about are true, and those experiences are a direct result of our outdated and overstretched networks, hardware, and software. The only way to correct this problem is through a major increase in technology funding for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. This funding increase is critical if we are to avoid major threats and improve service to students and citizens. Four key factors have driven the critical need for increased technology funding. Number one, demand for 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day, 365-days-a-year online systems availability has ballooned over the last several years, and no additional resources have been available to provide this access for students, faculty, and staff, resulting in increased pressure on the core system and decreased reliability. As much as we might like to go back to 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, that ship has sailed, and we have to accommodate this demand for around-the-clock availability if we're to adequately serve our students' needs and remain competitive in higher education. The second factor driving this critical need is that our core mission-critical software and hardware architecture is approaching 15 years of age. Vendor support for this platform is diminishing and will soon be phased out. Hewlett-Packard and Oracle, who now own the products of this core infrastructure, these are former DEC products. Some of you might remember Digital Equipment Corporation that went under over 10 years ago. That's whose architecture we're still using. Have made clear, these AT and Oracle have made clear their intent to phase out support for these key products for us in the next few years. If we have not moved off these platforms on a more current mainstream technology by the time vendor support disappears, we will be unable to function. Our core administrative systems, student registration, records, finance, human resources, financial aid, etc., will be dead in the water. The third factor is that an increase in system downtimes and an increase, this is slide 20 by the way, an increased reliance on the availability of technology to support education, in significant part due to the astronomical increase in online learning, 30% and 40% annual growth rates over the last 5 years, has made periods of system overload and unavailability much more disruptive than 5 years ago. Downtime can no longer get absorbed without major disruption to students' education. This growth has resulted in a need to continually upgrade our hardware and software, and also to increase staffing to make sure that online services remain online around the clock with virtually no service disruptions. The fourth key factor is that significant new security threats, in addition, of course, to the old reliables of hackers and evildoers trying to get into our systems, have put our systems at increased risk for attack and identity theft. While at the same time, student, faculty, and staff demand for online access to more and more data in order to meet their educational needs and do their jobs must also be met. Without major increases in security funding and staffing, we put ourselves at significant risk for increasing security incidents. Mr. Chair and members, these issues are not one time and will require new ongoing investments to resolve them in the short term and maintain those fixes and continue progress over the long haul. If we are to continue to provide a quality educational experience for students in the future, a strong, flexible technology backbone is essential. As a result of these increasing hardware, network, and software downtime issues, in 2005, we began an in-depth study of the current state of information technology within the MinSCU system. The study report concluded that the key to resolving the problems and to position our system for the future was to significantly increase system-wide enterprise IT funding. First, to correct problems, stabilize the existing infrastructure, and then begin building a robust platform for future technological growth and innovation. When the 2006 legislative session did not approve our supplemental budget request of $15 million, one-time critical funding of $12 million from system and institutional resources was identified to begin work on resolving the most critical issues. That work has begun and continued with promising early results, but those results are early. Much more work is necessary over the next 5 years, and that is the basis for our current request. Slide 21 then lays out what that funding will buy. What will we do with the money if you fund our request? We're proposing the following four key initiatives. Number one is to provide easy and reliable access to all systems and tools, including true around-the-clock availability so students, faculty, and staff can focus on learning, teaching, and efficient business processes and not have to worry about whether the system is up or not when they need it at an important time. Number two, to significantly enhance our security and identity management to protect us against security breaches. That's the last thing we want to have happen, and significant funding is required to bring us up to the state where we can reasonably tell you that we've taken all reasonable precautions. Number three, we want to renovate our current systems to keep up with the required technical changes and efficiencies. These are the changes that will allow us to not be dead in the water and out of business when Hewlett-Packard and Oracle drop support for our existing products. Finally, number four, we want to make it easier for students, faculty, and staff to quickly and simply access the information they need through present-day web and portal technology. The current look and feel of our systems is not well integrated, and it is not up to current modern standards for ease of use, Amazon and MSN and Yahoo websites. That's the vision of what we need to provide for our students and faculty and staff throughout the system. The bottom line of all this, members, is that Minsky investment in enterprise IT funding has significantly lagged the increased demand for IT services over the last 5 years. We have begun implementing a plan to retool and integrate, not replace, our existing IT systems. We want to use what's there and rebuild it so that it can function for a number of years into the future. But we need significant budget support to continue, complete, and maintain those enhancements, to add innovative new technology tools as well, and avoid falling back to where we were 2 years ago, with significant disruptive downtime, security risks, an unacceptable service to students, faculty, staff, and the citizens of Minnesota. We need your help to complete and maintain this plan. That investment will improve efficiency and enhance educational outcomes for all Minsky students. Thank you. I call on President Frank, who is one of my cohorts on the Technology Committee of the Leadership Council, to either tell you that I was full of baloney in what I was telling you here today, or whether this reflects the reality at campuses.
Chair Rukavina and members, on behalf of all of our 32 colleges and universities presidents, we really do strongly support this initiative and have come forward at our Leadership Council of Presidents and reaffirmed what a critical need this is. So I think, Ken, everything you said is right on the money. We have so many of our students, not only online students, but using technology throughout the campus and the learning environment is very much a part of today's learning world on our colleges and universities. At Embry Hills, we have 90% of our students now registering online and getting advising, tutoring help online. So it really does affect everyone. And with the enrollment growth we've had, having technology that you can count on 24/7 has really become critical in today's world. And President Barton, would you like to add anything to that?
Greetings from West Central and Northwest Minnesota, Chair and members. As president of a state university, I can't emphasize enough the reality of the situation where we are in right now. We're in transition from an old generation of technology, even for the needs we have, and onto newer platforms. It's going to be an expensive infrastructure change, as you can tell from the request, but we are very dependent on this technology at this time and in the future for our instruction, not only for Minnesota Online instruction, but many of the courses taught on campus are hybrid courses. They are part traditional instruction that someone my age would remember, and part high-tech. And it is an expensive platform to use, but it is an amazing teaching and learning environment. So we look for your help.
Mr. Chair and members, that concludes my part of the presentation. I had some really cool props and a lot more funny material, but in the interest of time, they had me all cut that all out. So maybe some other year we can go through that. Or if you want a special showing, I can come up to your office and let you see the
you
new props.
You did such a good job introducing yourself and film that. I won't even ask
that was good enough. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And now, at this point, the Senior Vice Chancellor Linda Baer is going to finish our presentation to the committee.
Mr. Neame, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few questions about your part of the presentation. You actually, in talking about what will the funding buy, I read these as outcomes that you expect to get. I'd like a little bit more detail on what exactly the amount is and what's, you mentioned that it's somewhat ongoing costs, and I'd like to know what is one-time cost that you might actually be purchasing some things and what might be the ongoing costs, and if it's more staffing or if it's hardware. I guess I want more detail there, please.
Sure, Representative, Mr. Chair. It's a mix of all of those. I can give you plenty of detail on each of those areas. And the first item, for example, is a $12.7 million budget that we built up, and that really is focusing on the reliability of our systems. It includes upgrading of hardware, providing a disaster recovery site, providing additional staff that will allow us to have some backup around the clock. So it's a mix of all those three. We actually have 8 different projects that are aligned on each one of these. And maybe it would be valuable if I could provide that to the committee in writing. We have the materials available, and I'd be more than happy to do that.
And it may be somewhere in the materials here that we've gotten, so I just wanted to know what that was.
The trick, Representative and Mr. Chair, with the technology stuff is to keep it at a high enough level so that it doesn't get bogged down in the level of detail, but we have the detail available, and I'd be more than happy to provide it to the committee.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And then also, if you just give a sense of how much you're wanting over the course of the next coming years, because obviously this isn't like just building a building and you don't maybe do anything for a little while. You're going to be needing to upgrade on a regular basis. So if you could just give some background on that, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. The request includes a $40 million base increase that would be ongoing. That's our request. We believe that this is a project that will not be done in one biennium. It will continue, and by the time it's completed, it will be time for refreshment and renewal again at that time. That puts us into a budget range with many of our peers, and we think it's a way that will allow us to not fall back into the lousy times that we were a couple years ago, where things were failing and on the brink of further failure every day.
Can I just have one more follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow-ups.
Were there? I know that there was a point when really we kind of did drop out, and that not assist you in maintaining this funding for infrastructure. And I'm just wondering how critical that was to the now that we are really almost in a crisis point and trying to upgrade the computer system. And so I'm just wondering if there was a what we perhaps could learn from that, what I would call maybe a mistake in funding?
I think the lesson from an IT perspective is that IT needs are not one-time. They don't, and one-time funding seems good. If that's all you can get, it's hard to say no because you can invest it in equipment. But in the IT world, 3 years is an incredible amount of time, and equipment generally needs to be replaced on that kind of a life cycle. So that if you get one-time funding, 3 years from now, you're at a point where hardware is failing, it's out of date. You end up having, as we are in our situation, having to replace things with used refurbished equipment, which is nowhere near as reliable as newly manufactured is. You also get to a point where the technology you're on is so obsolete that a massive refitting is necessary rather than an incremental one. If you can stay incrementally in line over time, your long-term costs are going to be lower than having these massive projects that you have to do to catch up every once in a while. It's like a house with deferred maintenance. If you haven't replaced the furnace in 15 years or 20 years, and it's so out of date, it ends up being a lot more expensive to replace it than if you're able to maintain and upgrade as you go along.
Mr. Neame, I'd like that breakdown, too, of your $70 million.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
And maybe any others on the committee would like to see it. Mm-hmm. Representative Easton and Hartman, can you wait until we're almost done with the full presentation, and then we can ask questions then, because I want to get through it.
All right. Okay.
Chair Recovina, it's always a hard act to follow when Ken does his thing. So, but I'm here to talk to you about the future of the state, as he was. I'm here to say on behalf of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities that we are here to talk about the future. The state has been as strong and competitive as it has been because of strong commitment in previous decades to education, and we need to return to that strong commitment. The things that I'm going to talk about have to do with excellence, quality, competitiveness, and hope for our state. And so the first slide is slide 22 that talks about our recruitment and retention of underrepresented students. We have been here many times talking about the critical issues related to underrepresented students, and we're here today to say that we need $24 million to assist us in further expanding what we can do on behalf of these students. We need to talk about this because we have too few students coming through the pipeline that are ready for college. 42 of every 100 ninth graders statewide enroll in public higher education within 2 years of graduating high school. 42. In Minneapolis and St. Paul, that number is 24. 24 out of every 100. That just isn't acceptable if the state wants to maintain its competitiveness and the high quality that we've aspired to date. So this funding helps us do better partnerships with K-12 to make sure more students come to us ready, that we become better partners together in that readiness and in building those bridges. We want to expand our programs that provide tutoring, counseling, student support, assistance and preparation for college, academic and cultural enrichment, and guidance on financial aid. And we aren't coming here just saying, we'd like $24 million. We're coming with examples and product of programs we invested in because you did allow a certain amount of money last time, which was $1 million, that we put out as grants to our campuses, and we have evidence of programs that make a difference. We are patterning these after the TRIO programs, which are programs of long standing at a federal level that work. But far too few students who are qualified for those programs are able to participate because too few programs are funded federally. For example, President Frank is here, and she put in a grant for a TRIO program at Inver Hills Community College and scored 98 out of 100 on the points and was not awarded one of the grants. And so what we say then is the state must come up to the plate and use some of these proven opportunities to meet the needs of these students that we need to succeed in this state for the state to remain competitive. The next opportunity talks about more recruitment and retention information, talking about how we would allocate the dollars. We were in conversation with the presidents prior to making this request and asking them, with this great challenge we have, leading our strategic plan with access and opportunity, what would each of them do and how much would it cost to make the kind of performance gains we would ask of them. And so they came to us with these requests. $17 million in each year of the biennium, $12 million with the legislative appropriation, the rest we would make up in our own reallocation. We also, because our RFP programs, our grants for targeted specific issues have been so successful, we request that $8 million would go into an allocation within the new enhancing outreach and recruitment retention projects that we would do on an RFP basis to the campuses. And so that's what we ask for here. And we think that it's important. We think that we can make the difference that you need to see in higher education with this investment. Likewise, getting ready and enhancing the future requires some other major emphases, and those we're coming forward with in relation to innovations in STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We are at a place where we must have more investment. We must bring students through the pipeline better ready to succeed in these areas if we are ultimately going to get graduates in these areas. And so we are proposing measures that would bring more people into the STEM areas regardless of their major. So to begin with, more people in math and science fields in college, because our workforce is going to require that, whether they become a math, science, engineer, technology major. They are going to be needing to be more competent in those areas. So we are proposing first that we have programs that would bring more to those programs, to those courses. And second, very critical to this state, are more people teaching math and science and teaching it in a way that makes for success for our students. And so we propose doubling, in fact, the numbers that are teaching math and science, and also increasing the in-service opportunities for teachers to new and better ways of teaching math and science as they are already in the classroom today. And so we have those requests, and we propose measures, and we're very clear that we intend to meet those measures. The other critical area, of course, for the state has to do with health care. And we have been before you before requesting money to increase the numbers of nurses, and we have increased the numbers of nurses by 74%. We knew that was critical for the state, and over the past years, we increased by 74%. We show you that with the investment, we can come back with a product, with an accountability measure that says we've delivered. During those 5 years, nearly 14,000 nursing students graduated from our system institutions, and that's a lot of students, that's a lot of graduates, but it's still not enough. You've seen the newspapers recently, the article saying, we don't have enough school nurses to take care of what's going on, in let alone nurses in nursing homes, nurses in the hospitals, nurses in the clinics. So what we will propose is to increase the number of nursing graduates in the high-growth regions and promote retention of frontline caregivers. One, we have increased our pipeline considerably with the two-year graduates, but our hospitals now say they need more of the baccalaureate prepared and master's prepared. And so our projects would move toward that. It would move toward assistance in some of the serious simulation opportunities to help train our students so they will be of higher quality when they graduate, but also those simulation centers become community centers where frontline caregivers also practice and respond to sometimes those kinds of issues that they don't see regularly maybe in their practice today. You may wonder why we're talking about one specific area called electronic medical record technology. The healthcare industry has said to us that is their most critical need right now. And we meet with them in the health education industry partnership on a regular basis with the University of Minnesota, with our deans of nursing, with our allied health businesses, industries, hospitals, and this is what they came and brought to us, the need for this. This is what brings technology and better service and fewer mistakes to our clinics and our hospitals, understanding better the electronic medical record system. And so we propose that we would increase nursing graduates by 25% over the biennium. That would almost make 1,000 more nurses. That would almost make that. We would also be targeting specifically underrepresented students, underrepresented in that area, because we need more people from all areas and we need more diverse people in this field. I've spoken about simulations. They are wonderful. We talk about you wouldn't want to fly in a plane where someone hadn't flown the plane in practice runs before, but you also don't want to be in a plane that they didn't train in simulators. Today, healthcare is in a similar circumstance. Training in people not only in their clinicals and on the floor, but also deep training and deep practice in simulations. So they're on the sim patient before they're on the you, and that's a good thing. Finally, I will bring to you our proposal for the Bioscience Center of Excellence. We were very pleased that we received resources to establish 4 centers of excellence before. And they are up and running, and we have reports, a first-year report that we have submitted to you for the agreement that you would get a first-year report. And now we come to you because it's time for us to establish a Bioscience Center of Excellence. We are asking $3 million for this, and we will bring back to this state then and build upon some of the very powerful opportunities that are already here. It's time for this. We are working closely with the University of Minnesota and the bioscience industry, and it's time to set up our opportunities in biosciences. It happens that Minnesota State College and University is the only system in the nation offering degrees in every facet of the biosciences. We have biotechnology, we have medical devices, we have nanotechnology, bioinformatics, and renewable energy. Not only that, these are strong programs, many of them with national reputations and national resources coming to them. So this bill would create a new and powerful resource that combines the best of our bioscience programming across the system in coordination and connection with the fine research and high levels of opportunities that the University of Minnesota brings to the table as well. We have been at the table with the bioscience industry. They are supportive of this. We are in coordination with them as we talk about that. And the Bioscience Alliance of Minnesota is one of the committees I sit on with Frank Serra and with others from the University of Minnesota and with the high industry areas. So with that, those are our requests from this perspective. I am happy to answer any questions at this time or open it up. We do wrap up with the fact that this request brings to you a package that will strengthen this state through education. It will make our students more competitive, a higher quality of education, which translates into a stronger workforce, stronger career development, stronger staff, faculty on our campuses, and we believe it's time for Minnesota to do this. We have the access and affordability, which will raise the participation and achievement. We have more affordability in the cost of attendance. We have high-quality programming that we're bringing to you, again, paralleling not only our strategic plan that the Board of Trustees developed and approved, but also what you say to us as legislators in the legal language that established the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We are meeting economic and regional development needs. And finally, we're building organizational capacity to innovate and change as needed to meet the needs as we find it important to do. That's why part of the reason why our technology request is very, very critical, because to innovate requires the highest level of technology and capacity there. And we do believe we are accountable, and we will stand and continue to be accountable to your questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I think Nina and Anders, why don't you pull a few more chairs up there, and why don't Chancellor and Ms. King, Mr. Neamey, come on down, and we'll open it up to any questions you have for any of them, and we'll start with Representative Hartman and Eastman. Of course, Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this could be a rookie question, and staff can maybe help me with it at a different time if this how it, things are done. This is my first time on a finance committee, but the level of detail is just so, we're at 30,000 feet, and I feel like the taxpayers in my district are going to ask me, how do you know that you're spending this money correctly? And I have no idea based on the information that we've gotten so far. And maybe later in the process we get in much more detail about what these expenditures are. But the level of detail we were talking about in the technology expenditure, I would really like to see across the board, because I don't feel like I can vote to spend, you know, almost $200 million without knowing how it's being spent a little bit more than that.
Mr. Chair, if I might, there's...
Ms. King, as the former Commissioner of Finance, do you want to explain to the sophomore member how in detail she should get on our budget?
I was only going to inquire if your members, and I see that one has it, you should have Department of Finance pages, and you'll see much more detail in those pages that we didn't repeat here because we were relying upon that material being in front of you.
Right. I've read through all those, and they're pretty much, I mean, they might be at 27,000 feet, not 30, but they're pretty high level. I mean, for the staffing on the technology project, all it says is $5 million. You know, how many people, where?
Well, I don't know, you know.
I guess.
You could come, you know, I'm actually up in a space capsule on a lot of this stuff myself, so I'm up, you know, running out of oxygen, but... I think we'll get more expertise as we move on. We'll be asking the tougher questions. We'll get more detail than if you want to see on page 21 where we asked Mr. Neamey about his budget. You know, you can see what's spelled out there on his funding detail, but I think our fiscal analyst wants even more detail than that. And then you can go to him. Remember, Mr. Berg is everybody's fiscal analyst on this committee. And
lucky him.
He, yes. and he does a great job, and he's been around here for years, and if you have any specific questions that you don't understand, he is a nonpartisan staff person who will help all of you on this committee. So I guess that's what I would answer for you at this time. Mr. Berg, do you want to say anything else? But he answers to me in the end, so that's, you know, no, not really.
Thank you.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm back on the technology and infrastructure stuff here. And I just had a couple of questions. First, I think we understand that a big chunk of this is for just the normal operations that are happening inside of Minsky, record keeping and all the business functions and that sort of thing. There's a big chunk of this that's for that. But we're also talking about this online learning thing that's really kind of taken off and going like crazy. And my first question, I have a couple of them, but my first question is can you talk a little bit about the online learning and how many, what percentage of the activity going on in Minsky now is in that category, and where you see that going as relating to the whole picture as far as capacity and that sort of thing?
Sure, Representative Eastland, this is Mr. Chair. I think Linda Baer, our Senior Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, is our expert on the academic portion of that, which I think is what your question is driving for.
Chair Rick Vina and Representative Eastland, yes. It's of interest to know that in 1995, that was about the time online education started, and it was really innovative then. Today, almost every course that a student takes is touched in some way or another by online, either by services, that is registration services or tutoring or having a syllabus online, having information online, chat line from the peers in the class to the instructor. In addition, we have been building out programs online, and that's where you hear 40% increase every year in relation to that. Today we have about 42,000 students taking online courses, 42,000. Currently, about 10,000 are solely online by headcount, about 10,000 solely online. The rest of that number is the blend, or what we call hybrid, where some part of their course is online, either through resource material. Sometimes that helps us with the book textbook problem because many resources are online. We're building out libraries as well. We have the opportunity. We have about 190 full degrees or certificates or diplomas online, and that keeps growing. So that's a little of the overview of what's going on online. In addition, students expect 24/7 assistance and advising. So we have licenses with software that allows for that, and we have a call center where people can call and say, I've got a problem now. And far better to be able to answer questions on the spot when they come up than having to have them wait for office hours or sometime when someone might be available on site.
Representative Eastland, I'd like to add a little bit to this and have Linda speak to it again. I have the privilege of meeting with the faculty unions in the meet and confer. And I think the faculty in this organization have moved very rapidly to using the new technology in their classes. And I know when that breaks down, we hear a lot about it and a lot of need. Do you want to talk a little bit about the D2L program? Because that's much more in addition to the online learning. I'd like you all just to hear about this because this is a major part of this too.
Chair Rukavina and Representative Eastland, what the Chancellor is referring to is called D2L, which is Desire to Learn. It's a learning management system that's in place. Over these past 8 years or so, major software has been developed to support our faculty and our students in their learning opportunities. So where you might have taken a midterm and a final, and that's about when you knew where you were, and sometimes you would have had a grade on a paper. Today, any student can track where they are in a course at any point in time because of the record keeping happening in D2L. It's a related to programs you may have heard, WebCT or Blackboard or some other products, but for the University of Minnesota, I think they're still using WebCT. So the issue is major investment, but then every student at every campus at sometimes the exact time are all on our technology system at the same time, at a final time, at a startup time, at a registration time. So we can do a demo and show you more of what's going on, but students can manage their learning opportunities within D2L, and faculty manage and expand what they do in their teaching and service as well.
Maybe, Representative Easton, if you're done.
I'm going to
go ahead.
I think what I'm hearing you say is that there's a lot of students who use the online component, and I think just for my benefit here, part of the thinking when there's online learning that it's happening off-site, that there are non-traditional students who do not come to the campus every day and do not spend. How much of the online learning component is people who are taking correspondence-type courses off-site?
Chair Rivlina and Representative Eastland, about 7% of our enrollment is online today for the Minnesota State College and Universities. About 10,000 are solely online. What we have found, the most likely person taking online courses is a student that's on-site. And it's to expand their scheduling capacity. They couldn't get it on site when they wanted it, how they wanted it, or because so many of our students are working sometimes full-time, they are taking online because it's more convenient for them.
Just one more.
Go ahead.
I think that, you know, we all kind of live in this world where we are led to believe that technology is going to improve our capacity, it's going to improve our efficiency, it's going to improve our performance. And I mean, and when we invest these amounts of money, can you talk a little bit about the efficiencies that are going to be gained at the level, at student service level, and are we going to be able to deliver better services to students at a lower cost when we get this system done? Or is this just going to be an enhancement that's going to continue to add cost and add bells and whistles that are just going to continue to cost more?
Chair Rivlina, Representative Eastland, I'll take a first stab at that, and let maybe Lyndon and the presidents also have can weigh in. But I can point to one example of something that's happened in the 8 years that since I've been at Minsky, and that is moving registration to basically totally online. For those of you that attended college maybe in the 70s, you may remember spending 2 days waiting in line after line to get maybe a punch card, so it was semi-automated, and then going to the bursar to pay and waiting again and again, and finding by the time you got front of the line, all the slots are full, you had to go get a professor sign up, all that stuff that was right now students can go in online without having intervention by any staff, and for the most part register for their full class load, make choices, put that together. Our enhancements on that will make it even easier. There are things like planning activities to try and ensure that they're going to graduate on time, things like that technology can enhance. But those are real efficiencies that are in place now. The others all build on that same along that same sort of path, whether it be advisement, whether any of a number of things. Financial aid can be improved. Things like that take it away from having to stand in line and talk to a person behind the counter and letting you do it yourself.
Chair Rivlina and Representative Eastland, briefly, that's the service side. And we are all demanding better service, more convenient service, more personalized service than ever before. And that's the side that makes the service better. On the other hand, and I think your question is addressing the issue, is it better? I sometimes use the example that you could balance your checkbook by hand, better or worse. You could take a calculator and balance it, or you can even put it on your computer and have a software package that helps you balance a checkbook. What you're gaining are efficiencies in probably keeping track of the money better. But was it any better? The number is better, but did it allow you to be a better money manager? Maybe not. What we now have are training programs for our faculty through our Centers for Teaching and Learning in pedagogy. It's not tag on online and teach the way you used to. It's very different than that. And what you're asking is, does it make a difference in teaching and learning, I would imagine? And it does. And that's what we keep working on. We keep working on how do we take the very best of what's online and make the learning better, deeper, better motivation, better answers to questions when people need them, so our students can be more successful.
Well, it's great to hear, everybody talk. Representative Easton, as maybe Ms. King and I can talk about the statewide system project, and the $27 million, if we put it in 1996, would save tons of money for the state, and we wouldn't have to use paper anymore, but that never happened either. But let me just throw something at you, because when the students came in here, let me tell you what some of them said. They said your D2L system causes them sometimes some severe problems, that the servers break down, that it's extremely slow in rural Minnesota especially, that sometimes the connectivity doesn't work at all, that sometimes it takes 3 days instead of 2 days in a line to... That's what we heard. Now, so I guess my question would be, is the $40 million that we build into the base that's broken down here into personnel and supplies and anything, is that going to be geared towards that, Mr. Neamey? Is it going to look at some of the special needs maybe at your greater Minnesota campuses where the infrastructure might not be the same as in the metro area?
Mr. Chair, the significant part of that dollars, as we said in our presentation, is focused toward, people are going to kick me if I say this, but I call it hygiene needs. We've got to get, you know, you got to walk before you can run on some of this, and we've been just trying to stretch as far as we can, and the reality is we've had periods where because of hardware failures, because we're running old machines, because of lack of bandwidth, for example, in the networks, those kinds of things were the end result that were there. Also, the increased growth where the enrollment still stayed far above the system's ability to do that. So the bulk of those kind of investments are directed toward that. Increasing bandwidth across the states. Now, I can't do much about what happens between somebody living in their house and embarrassed and trying to dial up into the Internet to access anything any more than Amazon or Yahoo can do anything about that. But what I can do is to size of the pipe that goes to our institution so they can sit in the library anyway and access that. It's really difficult to do something with the rest of that, and frankly, I think that's part of the Office of Enterprise Technology's job to move that forward. And I know predecessor, the commissioners of administration and state CIOs have made that an effort. David Fisher is one in particular that was focused on that, increasing the speed of networks in areas that aren't particularly well served.
It's funny to bring up embarrassment because we were talking by a neighbor in Britt, which you know where Britt is also, and here's how his internet works. He's got a little receiver now, and then the receiver is pointed towards the water tower at the forestry station at Sand Lake, where it then gets beamed to another tower at the top of Lookout Mountain north of Virginia. From there, gets beamed towards the top of the water tower in Virginia, then goes down and goes into the fiber optic network. So, but it still takes him a few minutes to get a picture up. He can go split a cord of wood while he's waiting. So,
Mr. Chair, those technologies are a year ago. You probably could have said that those are improving. That
they are
every 2 months. There's a new result, and that's kind of the future, particularly I think in the non-metro areas or the metro areas.
Well, if anybody else wants to jump in, because I remember one of the teachers, I believe, from your district that testified. And they told us some interesting facts. First of all, that you charge more for an online course than a regular course. I can't remember what the difference was. Also, the stress that the teachers, because now they not only have to do their time with the students, their teaching time, but now, basically all night, they're online answering their emails and that. So... is there something in here, or is that in the other part of the budget with our compensation in that that's going to maybe help some really stressed out people that are the ones teaching the students?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to tell you that I spend quite a bit of time meeting with the student leadership group on a regular basis, trying to listen, and I have opportunities to listen to the faculty. And I think all of the problems that you heard, we have heard, and this is an effort to try to move this forward so we can improve all of that for our faculty and our students. That's one of the great things. Also, I thought Vice Chair Poppe asked a very important question, and I just want to make sure that we're clear. This request that we have is both for one-time money, some of it, and some of it to be built in the base. That was a very excellent question. We are happy to have some one-time money for some of the investments, but to make this really work, we have to build both equipment rentals and personnel and so on into the base. And out of that, the governor did recommend $60 million, but I believe that was one-time money.
and we would try to persuade... 45 was one-time money. So we would persuade you that it's both base and the one-time money.
Representative Poppy, did you have another question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I think, Dr. Vera, you talked about that 42 out of 100 students are not ready. Is that the terminology, I think? I'm just wondering if those are admitted students to the college, or those are... That's how you're tracking that?
Chair Rukavina and Representative Poppy, those numbers were those that go on to college within 2 years of graduating from high school. It didn't reflect readiness or not. It reflected that they chose to go on to college.
Do you have a sense of how many students are needing remedial work or developmental classes when they enter the college?
Chair Rukavina and Representative Poppy, yes. We, in fact, do a report on readiness as high school students attend our colleges and universities. If they test into remediation, then they are then a report is done to send back to the school district that, in fact, this many students from your school district actually did end up needing remediation. Now, there are a couple of factors going on there. Our colleges are open access. The requirement to get into our colleges is a graduation from high school. Therefore, the prep standards for taking the courses that sometimes really make you ready for some of the more advanced kinds of programming at our colleges or universities is missed when you don't take math in high school, for example. Those that are going to our universities do take a prep standard, 3 years of math, years of social studies and language and so on. They come in better prepared. Our numbers right now are approximately 30% requiring some remediation. Often only one course, and once remediated, they do quite well. Sometimes it's two courses, but we are monitoring that very, very much, and some of the requests for serving the underserved would be working more closely with our school districts about what readiness really means, whether you are aspiring to college or university. We have a fabulous program that's being piloted in the Fergus Falls area where a faculty member at Fergus Falls is working with the school districts in English. And he took an essay, for example, and he said, at the high school, how do you judge this essay in terms of accomplishment and competency? He took the same essay and had college-level faculty review, and there's quite a gap between what would have been considered readiness for college writing. Those kinds of programs are what we're also beginning to do in math as well.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, another question, and thank you, Dr. Vera. I'm fairly familiar with the students and their readiness. I do work as a college counselor at a Minsky institution, but I guess I'm wondering then, too, because I think that we do need to try to close that gap and really try to work with the K-12 system in order to help improve the readiness for the students. And I'm wondering, I know that that's one of the initiatives, as far as a benchmark or timeline for you, as far as you've got 30% now, but that's 30% of entering students, and if we're trying to increase the numbers of entering students, that likely is going to increase if those students continue to be not quite ready and prepared well enough. So I'm just wondering if you have a sense of some benchmarking or timeline as far as the what you're looking for as results.
Chair Rukavina and Representative Poppy, yes, we do have some benchmarks in mind, and it would be establishing very strong partnerships between our colleges and their school districts that most feed their college and our universities and school districts that come there to have the conversations about what does it mean to be ready. But we also are doing proposing and building off of programs that have built powerful summer bridge programs and more intensive readiness and orientation. I think President Frank can speak to one that was funded from last year's allocation, in fact, for serving underserved.
Well, we very much want to thank the legislature for some seed money to get an initiative started that we found to be very successful. We called it Ideas Plus, and it was dealing with some intrusive intervention within our students that are most at risk. They were not quite college ready in all areas, and typically in the community college that tends to be in the math and writing areas most prevalently. And so we use some of the techniques we've learned from our TRIO programs, whereby we're doing creating learning communities within the courses that the teachers are offering. We ended up with a phenomenal retention rate in this cohort of group, treating them like learning communities, really doing the student success kinds of techniques within the course environment. So now what we're trying to do, and the monies that if we would get this from the legislature in terms of access and opportunity, what we've learned, we want to lift up then throughout the college. So the motto at Ember Hills is finish what you start. And we want to get our students to graduation, to goal. So we are starting to benchmark, and that's one initiative once we get the students. President Ron Thomas and I just a few weeks ago met with all of the Dakota County superintendents. We have many school districts to deal with in our service area, and did get our biology faculty together this fall to do the same kind of work that Fergus Falls is doing. We did the same with math. This has to be ongoing, and I think in the long run we can help make a difference. But when you have at-risk students, it does take more work to help them. 44% of our students are first generation. They need extra help to know how to navigate the college system, but we're helping them do that. We were up actually, Linda, Senior Vice Chancellor asked me yesterday, we are up 10% now this spring, and this is a lot to do with this Ideas Plus initiative. 200 more students we retain, 200 more this spring semester are new students. So I want everybody at our college talking finish what you start and helping our students to plan throughout the coursework and entire college we're dealing with. So we have momentum there.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to follow up on Representative Poppy's question, and I have a second one after that. First off, thank you for coming here and your presentation. It's good to see another Bemidji State University legacy working down in the Capitol. Representative Denver here. I'm sure Representative Rukavina has spent a good deal of time there too. I know he has.
Are we just trying to get more people in trouble
now? Let me get back to the question here.
Okay, make it short now. You pontificate too much. Get right to the point.
College professor.
I'm looking at the governor's proposal here, and he has an Achieve 2 program, which is going to be awarding scholarships for students who participate in PSEO programs, which we have at Bemidji State University, successful program. And however, when we have finite resources, and as Representative Poppy was asking, and you, Dr. Baer, responded to, we have students who aren't arriving at college prepared, so they're taking remedial classes. Do you feel we can afford to be spending scarce resources on rewarding one group of students when many of us receive students who aren't prepared for college in the first place? And so we're essentially extending out the period of time that they're going to have to be in college. Those same students are going to be incurring further debt. And so we're, again, kind of creating this greater disparity between the haves and the have-nots in the education system. I see this problematic, and I wonder if you are courageous enough to try to take that one on.
Chancellor, maybe do you want to handle that one?
First of all, depending on how much money that the legislature and all of you believe that you're able to invest in the people of Minnesota, you'll have to decide how many of these things you can do, and you know, that will be a decision higher than ours. So I want to make it very clear where we are in terms of our system. The core value, remember, I can't say this with enough passion, last year we really tried to focus. We exist to enable the people of Minnesota to succeed by having the most accessible and highest value education in the nation. Now that leads us then to our number one goal, which is access and affordability. And that, in turn, leads us to the initiatives we presented to you. And I think we've said very clearly that we need to have a STEM initiative to have more science and math graduates. But at the same time, we have $24 million in there, which invests in the students that are having a hard time making the transition, getting them ready to be successful, at least at the two-year level and some beyond. And that's our focus, that group of students. If we were funded at that level, there would be 6,000 more Minnesotans that we would put the priority on of getting them ready. This is about the workforce. It's about the number of retirements. It's about keeping Minnesota strong. And that would be our value in terms of what we believe we must do. If there's more money to do more things, I'm sure these are really good programs. Linda, do you want to fix that?
I think you did a good job, to tell you the truth. Representative Briner.
Thank you. Just then a follow-up question. Again, back to the budget we have in front of us. We asked President Brunix the same question. And we, as Chair Rukavina talked about, we had many students come here and express concerns about their debt load, tuition going through the roof for many years. I know that's not, I'm not putting the blame upon you. However, you have a request here for $177 million. The governor's is $52 million, I think, below that.
That's right.
With the governor's number, can you keep tuition at 4% and 4%?
No. Can we do it without some payment cuts? No. Let me just address that. I think that's the perfect question. We were encouraged by the governor's proposals. They addressed many of these very important items, and we want to acknowledge that. But we need that $57 million in inflation. I mean, we have contracts that are coming up. We have employees, our faculty and others, that have been slipping somewhat in relationship to the competitive. And we need that $57 million in the base for inflation. And that would be added to the $73 million that the 4% would produce. So I want to make that case that we need inflation money. And the board has said, and I think we referred to this yesterday, they felt so concerned about the students, concerned that we've looked at the debt loads, we've looked at what's happened, and I think they said it's their intention for it to be 4% no matter what happens. So we're not going to raise it beyond that, regardless of what the legislature would do. And I just say that because of that deep concern. Now I want to go back to a little bigger philosophy, though, for just a moment. It's so important. Just 6 or 7 years ago, 67% of the budget of the public institutions was an investment in the people of Minnesota, because they believed that contributed to the common good, the economic vitality, quality of life, and so on. It has gotten down to about 50. This appropriations request that we have presented to you takes us back to 53 or 54. This is not because costs are out of control. We'd look forward to giving you the data on that. It's because we've done the shift. So I hope for the future of this great state that has always invested in its people, I hope we can move the line back over time to greater public support. So to be very blunt on your question, if we don't get that $57 million, and if we wouldn't get the $73 million in tuition, I don't know how we can bring it together. I remind all of you, this is just a small fact. We've got 8,000 more students that we've taken during this time. That's the size of Hamblin, McAllister, and Concordia. I mean, we have taken on more students. And if you remember, the law was changed so we don't get money for enrollment increases. My plea is, with all the passion I have, we need that $177 million in order to do these things that we need to do, in order to keep the tuition at 4%, in order to make the budget balance.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
You set
up the next one.
Hurry up.
Okay.
Whoa.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chancellor, I appreciate your comment. And just to be clear on this, you said earlier in that statement that you want to keep the tuition at 4 and 4 regardless of what we give you. So we're going to be losing programs, academic opportunities, and quality of programs for students. Am I correct?
That's where if we don't finance it, that would be right. The president's First of all, we have no choice. We have to balance the budget. We can't have a deficit. We are a very disciplined organization. Our bond issues depend on it. So I intend, and I think the board expects me, no matter what, we are not going to run a deficit. So when the decisions are made by legislature, governor, and so on, we will go back and we're going to make this thing balance at that point. And I do not see how we could do that without the $57 million in inflation. Now, to be fair, I always have to be fair, in the governor's proposal, there is a $25 million amount in the spring of 08 that would be given to us if we met certain goals. By the way, we welcome the goals. We want to be accountable. So we will meet the challenge of the goals if the money's provided. But that is not in the base. You can't do compensation and negotiations on salaries without money that's in the base. So that $57 million needs to be in the base.
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Baer, I wanted to return to the Bioscience Center for Excellence. And you talked about our partnership, or the partnership that would occur there with the University of Minnesota. And I'd like a little bit more explanation of that, primarily because there's often the discussion about complementary versus competitive programs, and I'm not putting a value judgment there at all. That could be a whole other discussion, but I'm just wondering how that would proceed in terms of that programming in relation to university programming.
Chair Gavina and Representative, we are working with the University of Minnesota in a variety of ways. And what I would say about that is a picture image. I remember going to 3M with the chancellor and with the president of the University of Minnesota, and it was kind of 3M day, and the University of Minnesota brought their very high-level scientists and patent-holding and patent-producing faculty members, researchers, and 3M was very proud. We brought the president of Alexandria Technical College and said, we make your plants work. We make your communities work. We were complementary. Their research is highly, highly important to increase the profitability of our businesses and industries here. But our training of the technicians and the career people that help make that kind of work work is equally important. So I would say that at the workforce floor level of what's going on with our business and industry. But on a second piece, bioscience is a huge field, and it's multifaceted. So whether it's agriculturally based or manufacturing based or bioenergy based, nanomedical, whatever, there's enough here that all of us need to be about it. Whether we are producing the strong pipeline as we are at Dakota County Technical College in nanoscience in partnership curricularly with the U of M, and then pipelining those graduates on to the University of Minnesota. And we actually share the clean room laboratory with the University of Minnesota. Our students go there for their training in their fourth semester of the program. Or 2+2 from our community colleges to our own universities and on to graduate work at the University of Minnesota. We are in conversations. And we're in conversations in the allied health field because of this statewide emphasis in a better articulated set of pathways. That's what it kind of looks like. Nursing's kind of interesting because you can do LPN, licensed practical nurse, RN, registered nurse, baccalaureate prepared nurse, master's to doctorate. Those are the things we are preparing curriculum together in, including preparing curriculum with the University of Minnesota.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back just ask one more question about the technology plans. We talked a little bit about the remedial needs of a lot of students. I'd like to go to the needs of maybe some of the more advanced students, the post-secondary option students. And my question is, are there plans in this process of creating more ability to service students online to really work with our K-12 system and to help break up some of the, I think, the inequity that exists there with students? Some districts are very capable because of location, because of size. They can offer AP, IB programs. They have arrangements with their local community colleges and so on, so that they work very closely. Is there some way that we can begin to extend into the K-12 system? Most K-12 systems, I think, have access to fairly high-speed internet, and is that going to be a concerted effort to really reach those students and give them opportunities to kind of get going on their post-secondary education earlier?
Mr. Nina, is that your question?
That would be the Senior Vice Chancellor's question, I believe.
Okay.
I got a little bit to add on.
Okay.
Chair, go ahead.
Sabina and Representative Eastland. We have online high schools in the state that we work with. We have an honors online that particularly Lake Superior College is doing, which then is, in essence, offering TSC online. So we have a targeted goal of building out full and complementary high school curriculum online, as well as using, for example, the honors online as an opportunity. So our students do have that. Our students also, because of the number of language changes to PSEO legislation, have considerable opportunities, whether we are taking faculty to those high schools or, in fact, hiring their faculty at the high school if credentialed and ready, which they show, and mentored. We think we've been able to push out a lot of PSEO opportunity across the state. And we can give you some more information on that if you
like. Let me just piggyback on that, on another, along this line. What happens then when a student takes a post-secondary option course over the internet as far as the charges? Obviously, then they don't go to your facility and the school district doesn't lose all their money, right?
Chair Ravina, correct. What is happening there, if they take TSEO, the school district is responsible for the cost of the experience for the students. And so that's where the cost happens. We have our campuses working very closely so that many times we've got win-win financial opportunities. I would say the financing of TSEO has been difficult because if you talk to some, if a high school believes their best and brightest are going over to the college or university, it means they lost them. Likewise, some will feel that the work should be college-level work, and it is. We believe that it needs to be that. But what we're working on instead are win-win opportunities, and maybe some of the presidents that are actually operating in PSEO circumstances can expand.
We can talk about that later.
Okay.
Because there's a number of questions, okay. But I'm concerned about that. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to any of the testifiers up at the front table. I was looking at the Centers of Excellence, and I remember when the governor rolled this plan out, and it was mentioned in here that you were looking at four Centers of Excellence, and then I looked down those lists of four Centers of Excellence, and I noticed that there are many two-year and four-year institutions that are a part of one center. So you actually have a collaborative effort, and I'm actually looking at this trying to figure out, did you leave any two-year or four-year colleges out of it? And we're supposed to have four centers of excellence. My first comment will be this. I think it's good if the four centers of excellence led to more collaboration between all of those university sites and developing, you know, and getting to the goal of the centers. Is that what took place? Did you end up creating more collaboration? Because then if I look at the $3 million appropriation that you want for a bioscience center of education, and I'm looking at it thinking that this is probably going to be a little bit similar to what you're doing with the centers of excellence, are we going to be having more collaboration between all of the Minsky institutions across the state?
Mr. Chairman Representative Weldy, I'd just like to say a word about that. And Linda and others coordinated that. But I have to tell you, I'm very pleased with what's happened on these centers. And I think maybe it was an unintended consequence, but we decided in the proposal to review which ones would get it, that we needed them to talk about their partners, to have a business partnership in terms of the relationship. And what I think was realized, and I might ask President Frank to just give an example, the power of the two-year institutions together with the university strengthened the center. A first example is, I knew this was working when I heard the president of Alexandria Tech talk about really working to bring high school students to the Alexandria Tech and work on their math in high school so they'd be ready to transfer in engineering to Mankato. In the case of our security center, which involves Denver Hills and Metropolitan, it was the power of each that created the synergy. Denver Hills is a very nationally recognized advanced Cisco center. And so I'd like her just to mention about how the power of both made it better than either could have done it alone.
Well, thank you, Chancellor, and Chair, and Representative. We're part at Denver Hills of the Center for Strategic Information Technology and Security. Denver Hills has been a regional academy with Cisco. We work with about 12 high schools, so we train teachers in the high schools to be able to bring their certifications to the college, and that helps advance place the students when you have national certifications like that, for one positive. But before the collaborative, we were one of seven national Cisco security, networking security training sites in the United, well, for quite a while there in the world. And now Cisco has expanded to some other countries, but we're still one of seven in the United States. We work with a lot of our major corporations. 3M actually helps provide an engineer who helps with some of the networking security because they bring their employees to our site. Cisco really helps provide a national state-of-the-art lab for us. And along with 3M, Thomson West, amongst others. And so we bring networking security expertise. Metropolitan State University and Minneapolis Community and Technical College have forensic security expertise and national certification that they've gone for. So bringing the three of us together, I think, really creates, in the homeland security world, quite an asset for the state of Minnesota, for our companies, and also career ladders for the students coming from high school to us in the networking security area onto the University of Minnesota or Metropolitan State University as well.
Chair,
member, I'm barging in here. Minnesota State University Moorhead does not have one of these centers, so not everybody has one. Several of our partners that were involved with us in seeking a bioscience center of excellence in this last round don't have one either, because none was awarded in bioscience. So if you dream along a little bit here with me, from our perspective, and we are a regional university, our context is the region and the people we serve. You could imagine our partnership with Minnesota State Technical and Community College in West Central area, Northland up north, Minnesota West down around to Southwest State and the other universities down in the farm country. We're all very interested in agriculture. We're very interested in bioethanol and biofuel. We're very interested in everything we can do to help inform the public about the tremendous public policy decisions that are going to have to be made in this area. We're very closely in tune with our District 7 representative, Colin Peterson, at the U.S. level, now the chair of the Agriculture Committee, intensely interested in this area. On the biotech side, I'm selling here, someone will yank me out of the way. On the biotech side, again, a regional context. Our big biotech industry in the Red River Country is in pharmaceutical testing in humans. Phase 1 and Phase 2, if you're familiar how all of that FDA process works out, many of our students, desperate for money, are human guinea pigs in this process. It is a major industry, growing like you cannot believe, because so many of the great patented drugs that whose names we are familiar with are now being brought out in generic form, all of which have to be tested. And there is millions of dollars being spent in that area now. Great need for scientists who are in quality assurance, quality control. All of the health industry people you're talking about, these people are confined for days while they're doing this test. in some cases. In many others, they've got that outfit is open 7/24, because if any of them have any problem, they got to be attended to right away. It's a major industry for us. And in Greater Fargo-Moorhead Economic Development, all through the Red River Country, this industry also includes operations in East Grand Forks. It's booming, and they are desperate for us to get our act together and help them. So we work with North Hennepin Community College, and that launches us through our consortium into the Twin Cities area. Guess who else is interested in quality assurance, quality control, and all of those kinds of activities in the biotech and testing area? It's not just biomedical appliances and apparatuses around here. This is a major economic center in the world, Twin Cities. And there's lots of stuff going on here, and we need to couple up to it better. Are we competing with the University of Minnesota in the research area? I'm a biochemist. I made my living as a research biochemist at the University of Wyoming for 18 years, and I'll tell you, we don't do what they do. You've got to fund them, too, or this will never work. Where do you think those products are going to come from that our students are going to be out there testing, and our graduates are going to be out there doing quality control, quality assurance, making sure as we can, that nobody gets killed with this stuff?
So there, Representative Welty.
Chair Rakevina,
Hold on. Just Representative Mahoney to that point. And then we got to get to Representative Gunther. I noticed he was getting hypnotized by that little green thing going across the screen over there. So I want to wake him up over there.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to follow up on the comments of the president from Moorhead. When you talk about funding our bio programs in our universities, you might want to have added that we fund in this state at about a rate of about 5% of what almost every other state in the nation does. This state does a miserable job of funding its bio industry and helping its bio industry. And I could go on for a lot more, but we've got about 4 minutes. I think what you said was only the tip of the iceberg, and I will just leave it at that, members.
Representative Clark, do you have a point to this point or something else?
Mr. Chair, I can make that speech, too, for the member. I believe exactly what he says.
Well, that's good, because I want to ask a question that would help clarify that a bit.
This point? Yeah. Go ahead. We'll stay a little.
I'm very interested in the interrelationship and the interdependency that's happening with our corporate community, the pharmaceutical industry, the pesticide industry, the biomedical product industry, and our education system. And I guess I would like, there's not time today, but I would like a listing for all of our campuses, I guess, on the what kind of dependency we do have on those organizations right now in terms of being able to educate our students. So that's one thing. You know, are we funding our biosciences to be independent, or are they all becoming dependent on these industries? And if so, I guess I'd just like to see what that is, how that looks. Because I think it does deal with some of the, you know, academic integrity questions. So could you address that maybe? And if it's not time today, maybe it could be another.
I think they can get you that information. I'm sure they can. It would be interesting to see. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, I can see why higher ed and economic development were put together after listening to this session today. I think we look at programs like dislocated workers training that we're going to look into later on, and job skilled partnership training, customized job training. You know, Minsku does a wonderful job of that. We are the envy of the world. I look at the demographic tsunami that was somewhat mentioned, that you're going to be short of students, traditional students, but you're going to be very long on non-traditional students, because they say the average graduate today is going to change jobs, what, 7 times, 8 times? We're going to need that online training. We're going to need that. So my question really is one that somebody can answer if they choose to, otherwise they don't have to. But what is the cost of not funding your request?
Chancellor, I think you might be the best one to answer that again.
Well, I think I'll be brief, but I think that, and I say this not being born a Minnesotan and only being here 6 years, this state is kind of the envy of the country in terms of what we've been able to do in terms of quality of life and not only national but global competitiveness. And all of the information that I read suggests that the way you stay that way is by investing in your most precious resource, the people of Minnesota. And if we don't invest in that most precious resource, and that means the private colleges, it means the great research university, it means our organization where we do 64% of the undergraduates. If we don't invest, I don't know how we stay globally competitive, because it will be the knowledge competitiveness that will keep us going. And so I think the alternative is that if we don't invest, we'll become more average, and we will not be the great state that we have been and that we wish to be. And it's not only also, and I think this is so important, Minnesota, one of the great things that you've had we don't want to lose, it's not only the economic vitality, but it's the quality of life. And that's why we're in here with the program for nurses and the program for respiratory therapists and all of those things, because it's the quality of life of our people and the economic vitality, because you won't get people here who will stay, but our own people won't stay and others won't come if we don't have both. So I think that the legislature, the governor, all of the leadership of Minnesota, we're at a very important point in our history. And I just make the plea that I know you have very difficult, I'm not walking in your shoes. I mean, I'm trying to lead this system, but I know you have other pressures and other things to do. But I just want to say the investment, this is not an expenditure, this is an investment. And when you invest in higher ed, it has all kinds of other ramifications. It's improving health care, it's improving all of these other things. It's getting the people ready. Now we have an additional challenge just for a minute. We are not there's a gap in Minnesota. We're not doing as well with some of the new citizens of Minnesota as we did traditionally. And we're going to be depending on a different profile. When you look at the workers of 5 and 10 years out, it's a different profile. Many of our communities now are more than 50% minority. And those will be our future workers. And if we're not able to bring the American Indian community, the African American community, Latino community, and an Asian community, if we're not able to bring them into a very high level of education, we're not going to have the workers to replace the retirees to keep us going. You said there'll be a student shortage. I am just as sure as I'm sitting here on all the data I look at, there's a worker shortage. Many of the businesses are, if they're not talking to you already, they're going to be saying, where are we going to get the replacement? And they've got to be of even higher quality than before. Some people say that we need at least 90% of our citizens to have at least some post-secondary education. Doesn't mean a baccalaureate, but it means some in order to be competitive. So I just, with all the passion and commitment we have, we want to be part of this. We want to be part of the solution. We need the help of state government. After all, we're dependent. Any of you, and I just say this, any of you that need us individually, I've met with most of you individually, but if there are questions, however the chair wants to handle it, we're ready to come. We're ready to bring the data. We want to be accountable. We want to be transparent. We know the investment's not going to come unless we do those things. So, Representative Gunther, I am also pleased the workforce and the higher education together, because I think it's all the same. And, producing medical doctors is about workforce development.
Members,
so, thank you.
With that, I think we're going to adjourn. I want you to know next week we're going to have the Office of Higher Education. I would like you guys to come back on Tuesday, because there's some wrap-up questions, I think, yet. You, Representative Martin.
I call up individually then.
Representative Clark has.
Chairman, I'm just wondering then if I could get some of the answers to the question I was asking.
They're going to get back to you on
Tuesday.
It. Members, do you think we have to have the Minsky system back in front of us? No? Okay. You will be back in front of us many times, I'm sure.
Mr. Chair, if you would want any of us, we want to look to your leadership, but if you would want any of us to meet with any of your members, individually, for whatever time it takes, we will try to do that.
Chancellor, I think that's your job to meet with these members, because you've got a big job to do to educate all of us as to what Members, if you really look at the ongoing money after the you back out some of the money they're getting one time, you have $72 million ongoing and $177 million request. I mean, we've got a big hole in this budget. And I would like to say then also that you'll be getting an email from Mr. Gelbman. The Senate wants us to have a joint hearing with them on the 27th at Arlington High School. And on the 23rd, there is someone here from the NCSL that wants also to make a presentation to the higher education legislature. So we'll send that email around, members, with that meeting is adjourned. Thank you.